Hey everybody, it's Joe here. Thank you so much for listening to Fright School. If you are enjoying Joshua's continued efforts to scare the living daylights out of me, please take a moment to give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or your favorite podcatcher, and please tell all your friends about us. Get in on the conversation by following Fright School on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Want to be a guest lecturer on an upcoming episode? Want to be a student? Want to submit a film for consideration? Got a question, or more likely a correction for Joshua, shoot us an email at info@frightschool.com. Thanks, and enjoy the show.
Hello, Fright Schoolers. Hello, Joe.
Hi, Joshua.
How are you?
I'm great. I'm feeling so good today.
Yeah, good for you. This is fun. We've positioned to a different part of the room.
I know. We've altered our seating arrangements.
Yes, yes. Which, I mean, might change again once I am going to get a new couch in here.
Ooh.
Yeah, this is going to be replaced. I'm going to have like a nice chaise lounge, fainting couch.
So are you gonna like just recline while we're sitting? Mm-hmm. Oh, that would be cool.
I might. Could you imagine?
Yes.
If I just like was laying down, prostrate on the couch.
Yes.
You just can't even sit up anymore.
Yes. I can't stimulate your prostrate.
Yes. Exactly. On. In other good news, you can see a totally different part of the room.
Yes. Oh God, there's Pinhead.
Yeah, there's Pinhead, who you've yet to meet, but you will.
You will. I can't wait. In quotes.
So how you been?
I've been great. How are you?
Wonderful. We've had like lots of time together lately doing things.
I know. Are you sick of me yet?
No. I always enjoy seeing you. Oh, it's fun. It's good times.
I enjoy seeing me too.
Yeah. Plus, I mean, you come to my house and we do this here, which is lovely because I have liquor. So, and that definitely helps you be a good time. Helps me enjoy your company.
Yes. You got to love that.
Hello, my name is Joshua, and I might be an alcoholic. No.
The first step is admitting you have a problem.
The world is crazy, so listen, I gotta have a beverage.
Every now and then.
Every now and again. Anyways.
Especially when it gets super crazy.
Yeah, I'm going to keep filling this room up with more stuff. You know, do you think I should paint that wall maybe and then hang everything back up? I don't know. I think that would look nice as like
an accent wall?
Like a gray, you know? Yeah, just because I have all the bookcases over here. You know, I think that wall would look nice if it was like a nice charcoal gray. But,
ooh. You know,
what do you think, listener, that is watching this right now?
I know. Podcasts are a visual medium, so.
Yes. We're going to change our title. It's going to be Fright School, Podcasts Are a Visual Medium.
Yes.
That has been an ongoing remark.
Yes.
Let's see. I've been watching AJ and the Queen.
Oh.
Have you watched any of it yet?
No.
See, I'm surprised. I really thought that'd be something you'd rush right out and binge.
No, I'm in the middle right now. If I stop, I will not finish it, but I'm still making my way through Scandal.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, I'm...
Watching lots of Scandal.
Watching lots of Scandal. Artemis Pepdani, Tony Goldwyn, Jeff Perry...
Names. I know
these are just names to you.
I know Artemis. I don't know who the other people you're talking about are.
Well, Tony Goldwyn is the grandson of the guy who's the G in MGM.
Yes.
So he grandson, great grandson, one of the two,
something like that.
Yeah. He's a direct descendant.
Some relative who has money and miraculously ended up in the film industry. Imagine
exactly.
That.
Exactly. I know. But you may know him as the man who killed Sam in Ghost.
Is that who that is?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He plays the guy who killed Sam in Ghost, and he's he plays the President of the United States in Scandal.
That checks. That reads. Yeah. Does that come back to haunt him? Is that one of the scandals?
Yes.
Murdered some guy?
He...
And then has somehow come back from the dead?
Everyone has murdered someone in the show.
Oh, is that the thing?
Yeah.
Well,
you know.
I mean, it's about the President stuff, and I mean, he's like head of the, you know, biggest murder machine possible. Agriculture.
This is a spoiler, but he does murder a Supreme Court justice in her deathbed.
Oh, like, you know, just smothers her.
Smothers her.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Well, lovely. This yes. is great. Lovely television you're watching. You're like, you're telling me, you know, you in your everyday life, you're trying to get away from the horror. But here you are.
Here I am watching, like, you know, presidents killing. The attorney general has, like, you know, a severed head in his freezer. Like, it's just
hot.
It's really hot.
That yeah. is sexy. So besides Scandal, what else is going on? What's happening?
What is happening? Oh my gosh.
We're in January. Have you got back into the groove at the work?
Yeah, I've got back. I guess I've gotten back into groove at work. I do have like one, I do have one quote unquote resolution.
Oh.
It is to, it's to bring my lunch every day, at least 4 out of the 5 work days. So, you know. I think that's admirable.
Yeah, I do too. You know, I've been doing that actually for the last couple months, you know, because I really sat back and I looked at like how much money I was spending just on lunch every day, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you go, well, you got to eat. And next thing you know, you've spent $22 on nothing.
Yeah.
You know, so
when you could spend that buying stuff and then have lunch for like a full week.
Yeah. And my job, like we have a cafeteria right down the street. So it's just easy to be like, I'll just walk over to the cafeteria and give money back to the place that's constantly,
yeah,
like stealing my labor.
Yeah. near my office, there's like a little market. So I'm always at the market buying, like, you know, and they have like coffee drinks too.
Yeah.
So I'm always getting like, you know. If I need that little pick me up and
yeah, meal prepping is a thing, man.
Yeah. But you see, know? I don't want to call it meal prepping.
I know, because it has a whole thing.
It's a whole thing and it's tied to wellness and, you know, I don't like, and then the idea of like making like brown rice with like, you know, pathetic roasted skinless boneless chicken breast and like broccoli and raw broccoli.
Well, I mean, you know, you don't have to make it like white people do. You don't have to make white people chicken. You can spice it up.
I can
teach you how to make really delicious chicken that you can use for a variety of things.
Ah, yes.
You know?
Show me. Instruct me in your culinary yeah. ways.
You know, I don't know. It's like the meal prepping thing. Yes, I agree. It can get a little like, you know, because I see people doing it and then they've made like 6, 7, 8, you know, whatever of the same exact meal. It's like, you're going to eat that every single day.
No, absolutely not. Variety is the spice of life.
Yeah.
And I will not.
You also really, I mean, for me, it's really about cooking at home in general and then making sure like I always overmake. So it's like I've got lunch and it's like, even if I don't eat it the next day, I probably can eat it the following day. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like that. It's like I boil a lot of eggs, you know, so I can take those and then I can have, you know, like boiled, you know, I can have a hard boiled egg for
breakfast.
You know, with breakfast, or I can chop it up and make like salad, you know. So do you have access to a refrigerator at work?
Yes, I do.
See, you can store stuff. You can store jams and jellies, get you some peanut butter.
So I've started bringing
mayonnaise. You can make things at work.
I've started making
this
my own.
This is so exciting for our listener right now. They're loving every second of
we
this.
Become so domestic. Welcome to, this is Fright School Home Economics.
Yes, exactly. This is the home ec class.
There's coffee and teas at work.
Yeah.
And I've decided that I want to bring my own because I like having my own. Because I do like the French vanilla, like coffee mate, like creamers. So yeah. I was going to do that. And then I'm so lazy because like I found this really great creamer. It's a non-dairy creamer called Nut Pod.
Mm.
And it's basically, it's like almond milk, but it's also, it has like coconut milk in it too and vanilla and it tastes really yummy.
Ooh, that does sound good. Yum.
It's so, so yummy. But the thing is that it has to be refrigerated and I have to like go downstairs to the break room to go get it, which means you know what I mean? Like it's so, I don't like leaving my desk for too long because I like to just pump as much out at work and, you know. I don't like to take too many long trips to like the break room.
You are not like me in that,
yeah.
in that regard. Yeah. Because I definitely believe in lots of breaks and yeah, the company should pay me to have a few moments of self-care.
Well, our building has completely outlawed, like they used to provide like plastic disposable cutlery and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They've completely outlawed that. So now.
This is where my Boneware.
Yes.
Here's an advertisement.
Hey, Boneware.
Advertisement. Yeah. Hey, yeah, exactly. So I should keep Boneware at the office. I use it all the time. I really do.
That's awesome.
I love it. Yeah, they it's great and it's creepy and weird and it's totally fits me. And nobody ever mistakes my stuff for theirs. You know, like if somebody's like walking around with like a bony spoon, I'm like, hey, That is mine, and you may use it, but make sure you wash it and return it to me.
Yeah, return it back to me.
But yeah, it never goes missing, so hey.
Yeah, so I took like all of the gift cards from Amazon that I got over the holidays, and I basically did like a giant buy of like stuff for meal prepping and taking lunch.
Right.
Yeah, not hate that word. Taking lunches from home. So yeah. I bought like a new lunch bag that you can just, it has like the gel, freezer gel stuff in the lining. So
ooh,
you can just put it in
fancy.
The freezer. Yes. And then I bought new, really nice, like food containers that are, you know, not leak proof. Right. And
new year, do you.
Exactly.
Again,
a little crock pot.
I love that.
Little, like, it's not even really a crock pot because it doesn't cook. It just warms things up. But, you know, if you take the little metal shell and I take it home, fill it with nice little goodies, and then 2 hours before I want to eat it, I'll drop it in my little warmer, and it'll warm it all up, and it will be nice and beautifully hot and not taste like it got nuked in the microwave.
Yeah. No, I think that's awesome. You know, I also like to make a lot of different, like, salads, and, like, we'll get, like, you know, get 10 chicken breasts and boil them. Mm-hmm. And then I make a really good curry chicken salad. I make a tarragon chicken salad. I do this really cool thing with noodles. It's like a sesame noodle chicken salad, you know, and they're all totally different, but all basically the same, like, work, you know. It's easy to just knock
out.
But
a boiled chicken, though?
It's really, because it totally falls apart. It's really delicious.
Okay.
Yeah, I know it sounds weird, but
it sounds flavorless.
Yeah, it's from that's the thing. So it's from when I was working at the Persian restaurant that I worked in when I was a teenager. I learned how to make all this stuff, like tabbouleh and hummus and baba ganoush and stuff like that.
Oh, that's why you're so good at that.
Yeah, I learned all kinds of really cool recipes from the woman that I worked with there. It was her restaurant. But yeah, so it sounds like it, but it's like, yeah, you boil the chicken, let it totally cool off, and then you just shred it, and then you blend it into these salads. Or you can chop it up, and you've got curry powder in there, and I put raisins and carrots and celery and tiny little bit of, what's it called that I hate?
Onions?
No, not onions. The it just totally left my brain. It's like people put it on their tacos. It's like green.
Oh,
cilantro. There it is. Tiny bit of cilantro, because curry and cilantro really go really nice
makes
together.
It pop.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you just turn up the volume. I know. Yeah, so it sounds flavorless, but it ends up being freaking delicious. And I use like Greek yogurt and mayonnaise in the sauce mix, to kind of give it like a nice.
And it's just like a chicken salad, like
exactly. You throw it on bread. I love putting it in pita.
Yep,
with a little bit of like feta cheese sprouts. Boom, you know, keep all that in the refrigerator at work. You're done.
Do you boil your eggs like in a pot on the stove, right?
Is there other?
Yes,
oh, you have that contraption.
Yes. So
I have the
Dash egg cooker that
I
brought.
Yeah, yeah,
this is, they're not sponsoring us, but like
nobody's sponsoring.
I love a boiled egg. I just eat like a hard boiled egg outright. You know, maybe put a little side of rice and you know maybe a sausage or two. But what I've been
I like
doing,
balsamic with it.
Yes. Yes. And with the boiled eggs, you put it in the Dash egg cooker, and it'll cook it in under 20 minutes, fully cooked. And if you adjust the water that you use, because you use a steam to cook it,
yeah.
You adjust the water that you use, you can do, like, you know, a nice kind of, like, semi-soft, runny, like a ramen-type egg.
Mm.
And then what I've been doing lately is I've been going to Trader Joe's and getting the everything but the bagel seasoning mix and putting that in the morning, putting that as the seasoning instead of salt and pepper for the egg.
Yum.
And it's very good. It's like having, like, a bagel but, you know, low carbs.
I love it.
Like the basics say.
I love this. I hope you're taking notes. Whoever's
listening. We
have
lost everybody.
Yeah, everybody was like, they skipped ahead of all of this.
All of
already.
Our horror friends are like, where is the horror?
Where is this going? You know, well, you could break open an egg and find like a little bird in it, you know, like in dumpling. That could be horrifying.
That's true. Or it could be someone's
dumplings.
Abortion. You know, it's just.
Right.
Know.
The.
Yes.
Like in Jawbreaker.
Yes.
All right. So, yes, good on you, good health, all of that. Joe, eat, spend less money.
Spend less money.
We need it.
We
for
have,
all of
we
our
have
trips.
Places to go. So.
Merch and paying for this ridiculousness to go on.
Exactly. Because
at least this part.
Yeah, because we've been doing this We've been doing this for a while.
We have. We have. This is a very fun episode. We are celebrating 100 episodes.
100 episodes of Fright School.
Mind-blowing to me. Even with like that section of time we took off after the first season.
Yes, we took
off.
You
know that we're still at 100 episodes.
Yes, we did. Like we took that time off and then we came back with a vengeance.
We did. We did. And we couldn't have done it without all the amazing listeners who listen each week and who share our whatever this is with the world. So we do really appreciate that. And yeah, I'm very excited. I'm excited for the film today because we are going to discuss The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari from 1920. So it's 100 years old.
Yes.
We're doing a 100 years old
movie. Oh my gosh, yes.
For our 100th episode. How exciting. And we will be back to deep dive into that right after these messages.
Saturday, February 29th. Throw on your bloody black tie best and join Dark Hills Gaming for a night of dancing, drinking, and horror. All in the name of charity. Proceeds from the Bloody Valentine Ball will go to the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. The ball will be a gore-filled gala that will immerse you in a horror-themed high school dance, complete with prom pictures, interactive events, and a horror memorabilia auction. Two lucky guests will be voted Horror King and Queen, complete with full carry treatment. There will be a bloody bar, so bring cash and your ID. This is a 21-plus only event. Buy your ticket now at darkhillsgaming.com and help us support the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
Alrighty, welcome back. I'm so excited that Marissa is doing that.
I'm very excited too.
Yes, it's very, very cool. So hopefully anybody who is on the East Coast listening will be interested in following up.
Or if you're on the West Coast, fly out.
Yeah, exactly. Well, of course. Yeah, sorry.
You know, resources notwithstanding, just, you know, go
just
and
do it. Just do it. All right, so we are here celebrating, like we said, 100 episodes and 100 years of the cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
Caligari. You know what kind of
calamari?
Yes, of Dr. Calamari.
Kari. Harry
Carey. Hari Krishna.
Ah, yes.
Do you know what Kari Kari is?
Go ahead.
So Kari Kari is a Filipino food. It's a Filipino dish.
Ooh, and it's made of sleepwalkers?
Yeah, yes, it's made of sleepwalkers. It's made of like insane asylum people. Kari Kari is a Filipino dish that is like beef stewed with like peanut butter. So my friend Gary always says it's like, he calls it peanut butter meat. It's kari kari. So, so when I was saying like, oh, I'm going to, you know, I was telling people like, oh, I'm going to go see, you know, the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. And then I just started thinking of fun things to do. Like, oh, God, kari kari, the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, the Cabinet of Dr. Peanut Butter Meat.
Well, you know, I don't want to, I would definitely try it, you know, as I was saying before in our first segment that, you know, I do my sesame noodle chicken salad I make does have peanut butter and soy and sesame oil.
Exactly.
In the base.
If you like peanut butter sauces or peanut sauces and things, you might like peanut
butter
meat.
It would be delicious.
So run out to your Filipino grocery store and ask for kari kari.
Yes. You'll bring that over later for lunch.
Yes.
I'm very excited. All right, so back to the horror. We are going to talk about this movie. So, yes, 1920. It's a silent horror film, the first, or silent film in general, the first one we've done on this show, right?
Yes, the first fully silent, yeah.
Yeah, which is exciting. It's also credited as being possibly one of the first horror films, which, again, when did we establish the first like feature-length film was actually made?
Did we establish that?
I don't know. You said something.
Well, I was thinking, I was asking Joshua when we were watching the film, I'm like, oh, is this the first like feature length film? And I want to say maybe it's The Great Train Robbery. That was the first feature.
It looks like the first narrative feature film was the 60-minute The Story of the Kelly Gang.
Yes.
Yes. The Great Train Robbery is not even on any of this, but there was other feature films made in 1911, 13, 12, you know. Mm. So regardless, this still, you know, even if it was the first, considered the first horror film made, it's still one of the earliest films in general.
Yeah.
You know, from the, you know, the beginning of film, and it's a horror film.
Yeah.
You know?
Roger Ebert said this is probably the first horror feature.
Very
narrative
cool.
Horror feature.
So still, even from the earliest days of cinema, what did we make? Horror. Okay? Horror endures. All right?
So, horror endures.
No more of this, like, conversation about, you know, niche or, you know, genre. Horror is very important. So important that it's, you know, one of the earliest films ever made is a horror film.
See,
anyways, that's just kind of going into.
I just mentioned The Great Train Robbery because there's a famous scene at the end of it where it looks like the train is going to go into the, or the train's going to go into the audience. And they had, like, people at the time had no idea that it was not going to, they weren't going to die. So they were, like, running away from it. Like, that was the power. And the newness of cinema at the time is that they had this, you know, it was people playing with the form in such a way that it, like, looked like they were going to get run over by this train. And then I think in the beginning, it's the famous shot of, like, the guy dressed as a cowboy shooting someone, shooting the audience with a gun. And, like, again, playing with that idea that, like, this is an image of a person, but they're not actually there.
Right.
Because introducing it to modern audiences. And how revolutionary that was at the time.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah, very cool. You know, I mean, the film has always been able to do that. You know, even now, like, we still, you know, you can jump at something that you know is fully, you know, is imaginary. It is on the screen. Nothing is going to jump out of it at you. At least not yet. I mean, maybe we'll get there in the future.
Yeah, exactly.
So this film directed by Robert Vina.
Vina.
W-I-E-N-E.
Yeah,
written
Vina.
By Hans Genovitz and Karl Mayer or Meyer. It's a German expressionist film.
Yes.
Obviously. And so it deals with Dr. Caligari and his sleepwalking slave and a coffin cabinet thing.
Yes. And what is it? What did we decide the pronunciation of the somnambulist?
Well, when I look it up, because it's spelled C-E-S-A-R-E. And then later in the film, once it's revealed that the doctor's inspired by this Caligari from Italy, I have to assume that it's Cesare.
Cesare.
That's like the Italian.
Cesare. Huh?
Yeah, that's the Italian pronunciation, at least that I could find. So likely Cesare. I've heard that other, you know, ways as well, like in other films.
Like Caesar, Cesare.
Well, yeah, but I mean Cesare. But yes, definitely. Could be Caesar, could be, you know, all of those things.
Yeah.
In the sense that Cesar.
Yeah, Cesar.
But it's spelled in such a way that makes me think that it's probably Cesare from the Italian.
Ah.
But again, with some of the conversation in the film about war and all of that, you know, there is sort of intention there, I think, to be inspired by Caesar.
Yeah, you know, especially how he kills the victims is with a knife. Like,
yeah, so now Caesar dies by the knife, but also like the war, or like the emperor, you know, imperialism of Caesar, which the film may be speaking to, not Caesar in general, in particular, but
imperialism
war
in general.
In general.
Yeah.
So what did you think, Joe?
I was surprised that I was pretty rapt by it. You know, again, like, I always struggle with these really early horror films, because, you know, I am of the millennial mindset, and I feel like sometimes I'm just like, I want to be interested, but like, I get really bored really quickly with these types of films. And I found myself being pretty rapt by it. I was like, oh, they really are enjoying, they really were not concerned with any sort of realism, which I thought was really interesting to be for like the first horror film, basically, like the first one of the first films, narrative features in general, to be like not concerned with realism at all. and you can see how the monster, you know, Cesare, we can see how the monster influenced other monsters. It's Dracula, it's King Kong, it's Frankenstein. There's all these different classic monsters that are referenced by it. So it was, I think this is a very good pick, Joshua. Like, this is a very, very good pick.
Well, thank you. I did want to find something that we could kind of coincide with, you know, with 100 episodes. I was like, well, what was made 100 years ago? And that popped out. And it's also cool because it's a film that, again, it's German, you know, so our first season was about, like, American film, so we didn't start with what is considered the first horror film. We started with an early American-produced, you know,
yeah,
Dracula, and then kind of went from there. So it's nice to show you this now when you have a visual language and an awareness of who Frankenstein is in, you know, in the 30s film, or Dracula, or Nosferatu, and having seen those films and seeing how this film, I do think, really established a lot of those kinds of tropes early of how, you know, villains are going to behave or how monsters are going to be portrayed. And again, he's also very sympathetic, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like Frankenstein and like King Kong and like the Creature from the Black Lagoon, which we will be watching soon. You know, you and on and on and on, you know, there's plenty of quote unquote monsters that it's either people controlling them or elements, you know, of the story where they're, you know, victims.
Yeah. And it begs it again. It's like, who is the monster?
Yes.
Right. Is it the person? Is it the slave that commits the murder, or is it the person that pulls the strings?
Exactly. Which is why this film gets a lot of interpretation. And I don't even think it's interpretation. I think that the writers have been very explicit. You know, one of them had been involved in World War One and left with a very disaffected what do you want to call it? Disillusionment of the military. The
other one
faked a mental illness to get out of the military.
It's very, like, it's the lost generation is all over this film.
And so there's a very, you know, pointed kind of conversation about the men in charge forcing, you know, young people to do their dirty work, you know, so they can reap the rewards of that, the resources, money, or whatever comes from, you know, warmongering and imperialism. And so I think that there's I find Cesare to be very sad in that way, you know, this sort of the victimhood of soldiers.
Yeah. It's interesting because you, in that regard, it's like we don't ever look at the person pulling the strings. We look at the person who is the direct perpetrator of it.
Yeah.
And it's like that distance absolves it because they are not the one, they're not, Caligari is not the one holding the knife, but he is responsible for the killing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly.
So it's that interesting thing again, like in terms of like imperialism in a military industrial complex, like reading of it. It's that it's not so much that the soldiers are to blame. It's the people who send them.
Yeah. And this is still, you know, before World War II. So it's kind of, you know, Cesare, the character, does fortune telling as well.
Yeah.
Prophecy. And so it's interesting that this film coming out of Germany, that's about to see the rise of the Nazi Party very, very soon, you know, after this film is made. And then you have that same conversation happening after the horrors of World War II and, you know, the Holocaust and all of that with people saying, I was just doing what I was told.
Yeah.
You know, so it's very prescient, I guess, in that way, you know, and although it doesn't take much of you know, I mean, it's like if we're like now, it's like we're seeing lots of, you know, horrors committed every day. And I know that those same narratives, conversations are going to happen. And I've even seen that with people that I, you know, that I've engaged with that have been soldiers that, you know, where I'm critical or I post an article or I talk about something and, you know, they want to kind of jump. And it's like, man, be real careful with the I was just following orders thing.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, even though I do, it's complex.
It's complex because in this situation, it's really, the villain is very clear that it's Caligari, because Caligari is the one that not only preyed on a weaker being,
you know, by being so, you know, mm-hmm. again, we discover that in the retelling, Caligari is actually the head of a mental institution, director of a mental institution that has, you know, found a somnambulist and is basically created this nefarious purpose.
It's a $10 word there.
Somnambulism.
So sleepwalker.
And he is the one who like preyed on him and molded him in this image. And so at that point, it's like it really draws the focus that the person responsible is Caligari, because the other person, you know, can't help but be taken from it. Like, yeah, has no
he's
agency.
Under this like hypnotism. This,
exactly.
Yes, yeah,
the idea
yeah.
of
zero
like
agency.
He is slave to the will.
Yeah. Yeah. Which again can get readings, not only like military and all of that, but I also think of, you know, wage slavery and workers just, you know, having to do what they're told so as not to, you know, lose their house or lose their life. You know, there's a lot that can be pulled from this sort of story.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I think that it's endured for so long because, I was saying when we were talking, when we were just watching and I was talking about it, it is like the prototypical slasher film as well.
Yes.
Uh-huh. You know, it's so like, you know, before we had a word for that, you know, you have, you know, small town stalked by knife-wielding maniac, you know, or strangler, you know.
A stranger comes to town all
exactly.
of a sudden.
Exactly. It has all those same, you know, elements of, like, you know, urban sprawl and, you know, the urbanoia thing that we talked about recently on one of our episodes, or, like, Halloween, you know, of, like, you know, the suburbs are not safe. This small, idyllic town with all of its weird edges and, you know, intense lines and shadows still is a safe place for these people that has been invaded. And so it's like it's interesting to see that as early as 1920, you know, and again back in novels and things like that. These are not new concerns.
No,
you know, these
not
are not
at all.
New ideas. And I find that very, very fascinating that it's we just see like the proof, like over the 100 episodes that we've done examining the horror that we have and what's to come. Like we're seeing these lines, you know, continue to be very important to humans. You know, mm-hmm. we haven't solved some of these complex psychological, social anxieties still in 100 years.
Yeah,
but it's cool
we'll
to see how far
be afraid of the other. I think it's very clear, and I think fair to say that we will always be afraid of the other. We will be afraid of what it is that we don't know.
Yes.
People who don't look like us, that are different from us. And
yeah. Well, and as long as that's being perpetuated by others, too.
Yeah,
I mean, as long as it's
yeah.
profitable and, you yeah. know, I think as well, you know, because it's a twofold. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not two. It's a multifold.
Multifold, yeah.
issue. But also, you said something that I thought was very cool about, you know, in 100 years of cinema, we've gone from Caligari to, like, the Avengers, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And it is kind of amazing, like, I don't think of 100 years as that long, you know, to be honest. Not when you look at millions of years or millennia, you know, that sort of thing. So it is amazing how much we've achieved as humans in a short amount of time from these, like, cut, you know, cardboard-looking type, you know, freaky sets and, you know, silent film to, like, CGI. And
yeah.
And I think that's something to be in wonder of. You know.
Yeah, absolutely. And to just know that this film, they were not concerned with realism. Like, that, you mm-hmm. know, I feel like it's interesting because early films, they wanted to capture as much of the natural world as possible. That was the beauty of, like, the early shorts, the early Edison shorts of, like, you know, seeing people dancing and birds flapping their wings and things like that. Like, those were all in an effort to show recorded movement and to show things that are not in front of you in a different way. And to have in this structure to basically create like this really interesting story using like, you know, German expressionist window, very
yeah.
crooked and, you know,
their hyper realism set, you
exactly
know?
Like, they to suggest madness, to suggest
yeah.
the odd nature of everything that's going on in the odd nature of everything that's happening in the film. I think that's very cool because, like, then you have movies like the Avengers Endgame where, you know, this is, it's real, but it's also very not real because of the different things that are happening in there. And it's, you know, we've been using stories and symbolism in that way. And I just think it's, again, 100 years is a long time, but it's also not, it's not a long time in human history. And to see how far we've come is, something to kind of be in awe of.
Yeah, absolutely. I used the wrong word. I said hyper-real, and what I meant was hyper-stylized. Mm-hmm. And you can see the influence of this film on countless others, you know, countless other productions. Obviously, I think of Tim Burton, you know, his films really feel like, you know, he saw this movie early on and it like stuck with him, you know, that sort of the black and the white and the weird crooked edges of things and the twists of reality. But then you have characters with these pale white faces and dark set eyes. And, you know, it's very, it's very much the Tim Burton aesthetic, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
First, again, a film that came out in 1920, to have that. And then, of course, right after we watched it, I showed you Rob Zombie's Living Dead Girl video, which is, you know, is just a remake.
Yeah, almost shot for shot.
Yeah. So it's just interesting to see how it's echoed, you know, into the future. And I'd be curious to see what somebody would do with that, like, now. Like, we haven't seen anything like this in a while.
No. I think it's interesting because it was very theatrical, so we've definitely seen it in the theater.
Yes,
but because cinema is all about, like, you know, some of it is like the hyper real, it would have to be super conceptual to do it that way, or to do it in an interesting way.
Conceptual. That's a good point. What was that film that came out where it's like they're all in like a giant warehouse, dog something? I think Nicole Kidman. What is that film? Mm. It's like they're in this big open space and there's not houses, but they act as if there are. They're acting as if there's a set.
I think I know what you're talking about, but I don't.
I thought it was dog something.
Because it's like they're acting as if they... You can see everything that's going on.
Yeah.
Right? We've talked about this before.
Dogville? Is that what it is?
Possibly.
Yeah, Dogville. Barren soundstage is stylishly utilized to create a minimalist small town setting. I think that's the last time we saw something in film that was sort of this amount of... conceptualism, in the modern era, which I'm not saying that they were directly influenced by Caligari. I'm just saying it's another way that I think that sort of bold artistic direction, you know, sort of echoes. But anyways, that's
a very like deliberate choice in the way that it looks, in set design, order to evoke something.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, again, like the films of Tim Burton are like that, you know, you think of Beetlejuice, you think of Batman, you know, there is this very particular style happening, you know, and I'm sure there's countless others, you know, that we have seen. Obviously, I think that the other big influence here is like on noir film, you know, the use of shadows and the use of lighting, I think really kind of influenced people, you know, in the 40s and the 50s. I think that can be credited to this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And again, noir is also, it's also very stylized, but it's more rooted in reality. So it's like, you know, just kind of like that step down from German Expressionism.
Yeah.
And it's very, actually shadows and all of that. Definitely.
Yeah. I just think it's an interesting connection. I like how, so talking about like, you know, there's kind of the little twist in the end of the movie that when it first started, you know, they show this close up or like this, what do you call it, like panoramic shot of the village, and you were like, oh, the houses look like flames the way they're kind of stacked. And I was like, yeah, kind of, you know, makes you think of hell. And I already knew kind of, you know, where the film goes and what the twist is and all. Not kind of, why do I say that? I've seen the movie before. you know, but I thought that was a very interesting thing to say early, because it's, it does kind of remind me of like, of hell, of people like trapped, you know, in someone's imagination, which is what kind of happens. This film takes like a Wizard of Oz turn at the end, and you find out that the story that this gentleman has recounted, because it starts with this old man and this young man, and this woman wanders by, and he's like, oh, you know,
that's my love.
Yeah. And we've suffered this horrible thing. And then, so he tells them this story about Dr. Caligari coming to town with Cesare, and, you know, the murders that happen in this small town, and that they've suffered from it. But then you find out that the, you know, at the end, the young man is actually part of the, is a mental, is a patient in this asylum. And he has cast the other inmates, and then, of course, the people, you know, that are controlling them as characters in this fantasy of his.
And that his hallucination, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah. Exactly, because he believes it's real, you know, just as Dorothy believes she went to Oz. And she comes back, and her uncles are there, and, you know, everybody was there, you know. It was very real to her, and that's a question. And so you get this, like, dual reality kind of happening, where, because when Dr. Caligari comes in, he's like a more benevolent warden of this place, you know, director, medical director, I guess, of this asylum. And he's like, oh, you know, I understand what he's thinking, you know, with this story that he's telling, and I think I can help him, you know. So I just think of Oz in that way.
Yeah. I immediately thought of Shutter Island.
Oh, okay.
Because you've seen Shutter Island?
That's with Leonardo DiCaprio?
DiCaprio, yeah.
Yeah.
Because the twist is, I mean, again, spoiler alert for a film that came out, you know, within the last 10 years, but it's similar. So he thinks he's this person who is investigating disappearances in this asylum, when at the end you find out that it's all his hallucination.
Yeah, that he's...
That he is the person who portrayed, you know, and it's just like, wow, that's such an... It was such an interesting twist, especially given the time period.
Yeah.
That, like, it's endured this far.
Yeah.
And those kinds of twists have endured till this day. That's really interesting.
Yeah. We enjoy a twist ending.
We do like a twisty turny ending.
I read that they were forced to have that kind of frame story and then, you know, the twist. But I guess there's, you know, it's interesting because this film, you know, because it came out in 1920 and, you know, again, at that time, you know, you're making films because you could. And you're not necessarily maybe documenting everything. You know, some of the people involved in the production, you know, passed away not too long after it, or died early before the film really achieved any sort of like cult recognition that it kind of has now, or, you know, that film history of like studying it. So a lot of the production notes or production stories are lost, or people took credit for stuff that they didn't do because the person that did it was dead, or, you know, whatever. So there's a lot of, when I was kind of reading different papers for this, there was a lot of conjecture about what was in the original script. 'Cause I guess one of the few surviving copies was what was his name? The guy who played Caligari. He had a copy of
the script.
And when people thought that they were lost, Werner Krauss. And he refused to part with it, so nobody could get their hands on it till he died in the 70s. And I guess there's now a transcript of it, which I did not look up. But it does include a frame story, but it's different than what was filmed. So they were probably, you know, working last minute, as happens. something else I did. So we have we've watched some other films for episodes that are coming up after this. And it was interesting because you said that you had studied this film, at least as part of...
I had an intro to film analysis course. Yeah. I had a film industry course in college.
Okay.
That talked a little bit about, like, it talked about the origins of the film industry going all the way back to Thomas Edison and the Black Mariah and the eventual how he basically chased all of the people who wanted to make films to the West Coast, and that's how the studios on the West Coast were founded, primarily from Jewish immigrants. And so, but we talk about Caligari specifically because of its place in film history as like this one of the first narrative films, German expressionism, how that style endures to this day. So we did, that's kind of, again, people who are like AKA film school people or, have studied early media, it always comes up. This film will always come up because of how kind of groundbreaking it was for the time and, the legacy that it still has.
But there was just something we were watching. I don't want to say what it was because it's going to come up on a future episode. Not this particular conversation, but the film, but you were like, oh, well, like that's from Caligari.
Yeah. Like there are things with the windows, because the windows, the expressionism windows are always interesting how they're, when you're watching film and then like, shadows happen with the window that kind of twist the windows in different ways. It's to suggest, directors, it can be implied that directors are doing that to suggest that everything is not quite what it seems, and the different framing of things within these windows. And it's used in Westerns, this German expressionist window, because in the film, the windows are very like crooked. Like they're
just the doors, everything,
Everything's so crooked, and the windows are crooked and cast these like nefarious shadows. And there are ways that directors have done that with, have suggested that using bending, but using bending with shadow and light. So yeah, there are, it still happens to this day as like, film school references to Caligari.
Yeah, it was that. And then they're like framing devices. There was something about the way that a scene was framed that you were like, oh yes, this is very like kind of originated there, or people maybe don't know it. And that's what's kind of, that's what's very interesting about this film, kind of setting the tone for a lot of future or a lot of horror to come in the future of it, is that people watching it then, if you've not seen it yet, you go in and you watch it and you don't yet know that those visual clues are there, that this is all a hallucination. A dream. This is all something that, somebody has imagined. You go along with the way it looks because this is, the town or whatever is just how it looks. Or you're used to seeing, theater production. So of course it looks like a stage, of course it looks like, a set, theater sets and things like that. But it does, it establishes so much that will continue into horror, into the film I'm talking about is from 2017, is still using that, something established in Caligari as its visual language.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's, there are several things rooted in that, And again, like I said, you go back, trace back the slasher to this film, that kind of, the sort of story that it is, the monster movie can be traced back, and of course those also exist in books and in novels before that, but to tell it in a visual way,
in a visual language,
use specific types of cuts or frames or lighting. And then you see that in films in the 30s, obviously in the 40s and 50s, but then even now, I just think is very, it's awesome. Again, it shows the influence, because not even in horror. I mean, these same, like what you're saying, that it's used in other films as well, to tell a certain type of story, to give the viewer a clue about something.
Yeah.
Pervades other types of media as well, other genres besides horror. And I just think that, again, this is just, celebrating 100 years of a film that has influenced countless productions after it is a horror film, and we're still fighting the dismissiveness around horror.
Yes.
And even in ourselves, of being careful to talk, like, what is elevated horror? Like, what does that mean? Like, it's a word in order to make people feel better about a horror film of like, oh, but this is one you take seriously. Like, there's plenty to be said in all kinds of horror. And I love that conversation is coming up more and more, you know? So
and if you think about, like, with the renewed conversation about camp,
Yeah.
And its place in the world and how, like, you know, is it, it's high culture, low culture, but then camp is now high culture, you know, like, it's just,
yeah,
like, is there, can it, it's hard when you're talking, when I talk about horror, I have to remind myself to not sound too elitist,
right,
and to, you know, it's always a teaching moment of people. It's just when people talk about certain things, it's like, no, like, that's horror. And, you know, you like, you say that you don't like these things, but you also like true crime, which
right.
is a different kind of mm-hmm. a different kind of horror.
Yeah.
You know,
and that echoes, you know, you're getting the same adrenaline rush or that same, you know, taste of death, you
exactly.
know, that you're getting out of horror, or that just wanting to feel that, you know, uncomfortable feeling, you know, you're getting that out of true crime or CSI or, you know.
Yeah, but it's coming, but like, instead of, you know, a knife wielding rapist, it's a knife wield, it's Michael Myers, like,
right.
Which, you know, because it's, people, it's like they want to be scared, they like having that release, but it's the degree of the intensity is not something that they play with. So, like,
yeah.
they don't want it to be too intense like Halloween. They want it to be, you know, a yeah. police procedural.
Yeah, but it's just interesting because it's like people that love, you know, Silence of the Lambs, it's like, well, that's a horror film, you know, and it, you know, plays on those same, you know, I use Silence of the Lambs as an example often, because it is one where I feel like I do have that conversation a lot more about whether or not what kind of film it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then of course we've had plenty of times on the show, thrillers and, you know, that kind of, you know, like, what does that mean exactly? You know, so I just thought that this was the perfect film to celebrate, because one, it's made it 100 years. That's freaking amazing. And hopefully there'll be something. We should actually look around. There's got to be celebrations of it.
Oh, yeah.
There should be.
It's coming up, yeah.
But also, as for our 100th episode, to kind of look at, you know, to look at the entire history of what we've done and see, you know, echoes of the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and all of it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And to still be able to watch it and get, you know, it's still relevant with its anti-war conversation, with its exploitation, human experimentation conversation. That's still, I mean, you know, you think of all the films, you know, that have, you know, The Human Centipede, for instance, mm-hmm. you know, obviously mm-hmm. we're mm-hmm. still dealing with your feelings around that. Human experimentation, I mean.
Like, I have a lot of feelings about The Human Centipede. So.
Right? Yeah, yeah. But I just mean, like, that exploitation, you know, with the sideshow thing there, and we still, you know, culture is still dealing, you know, and examining, like, you know, what is or isn't a freak.
Yes, uh-huh.
And how those of us who self-identify or do, you know, are proudly freakish, seeing, you know, how we might be exploited.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. not me. I mean, but I just, you know, the collective idea of that. mm-hmm. So anyways, I'm glad that you enjoyed it. It is a fun film. It's perfect. I'm actually thinking that maybe for the next Gore Fest, I might do a whole bunch of films like that. You know, it'd be really fun to see you all painted up in grays and blacks. You know,
ooh.
Get everybody come black and white.
Ah.
Come to my black and white ball.
Ghoul, it's like a Gore Fest noir.
Yes, exactly.
Ah. Noir blanche.
This is black white.
Yes, it's just
I
black
enjoy
and
that.
White.
I enjoy that.
I have a thought where, like, when you're, I know it's shocking. What if we, like, I feel like if I was responsible for, like, raising a child, which is a horrifying thought in and of itself.
Yeah.
But if I was responsible for raising a child, I would probably, like, very early on show them, like, silent films. Just because, like, you know, give them the very basis of, you know, because, like, it's all, those would be all things that they would, you know, because, again, like, you know, teaching children object permanence, right? Like,
right.
So we would show them, like, the old, the different, the Edison shorts, and show them the Great Train Robbery, and it's all things that they would enjoy because they're, you know, children. And it's something new and it's different, and getting their reactions from that and seeing how, you know, this is not to be dismissive or to infantilize the early audience, the first audiences that saw these films. But, like, you know, we're living in an age where, you know, we have, like, we have literally created galaxies and shown them on films with armies of aliens.
Yeah.
It would be interesting to like show a young child all of these early cinema, and then like later on show them, you know, show them a progression until they grow.
I don't know. That's interesting. You should talk to a child psychologist about these things.
You should.
And your own therapist as well, because I'm not sure about this. I mean, if you're seeing a therapist, because maybe you should, Joe.
Well, I do. I do see a therapist. Yay. Shout out to my therapist. I won't say his name.
Good. That's a smart idea.
Shout out to my therapist.
Good. Yes. Therapy is great. Everybody should have therapy.
Yes.
All right. Well, again, happy 100 episodes, Joe.
Happy 100 episodes.
I was
going
to get a cake with 100 candles
on it. I almost bought peanut butter meat to, you know, to give you.
That would have been a lovely gift. Wrapped up.
Just wrapped up in a little box.
We could have had a little party, just adieu.
Adieu. Yeah, a pas de deux.
But yes, makes you proud to look back and say, hey, we got 100 episodes.
Can you name your top two favorite episodes? Two favorite films?
Well, no, that's too hard. But I mean, I do think that our Silence of the Lambs episode was very good. I think our conversation, that was really good. And that's kind of what I look at. I'm like, I just think like, you know, we've had a lot of really good conversations on this.
Yeah, we have.
Podcast. We've also met some incredible people. I think of, you know, of Michael Verratti and Sam Weinman and Chelsea Stardust. And we have somebody coming up that
we
I don't want to say yet.
Up, Jack Chesson.
I'm very excited. Jack Chesson. I know I'm getting there. I'm like just trying to jump through all the people. You know, we've had tons of friends on this show, all his guest lecturers that have contributed incredible conversations. You know, I think of our Thinner talk with Adrian, and, you know, I think of our, you know, with Laura, we did the 28 Days Later. You know, that was a really fun conversation, even though it went
off the wall,
way off the fucking wall.
New Year, New You with Ashley.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's been great. We adore all of you. So if we left your name off, we of course do not, you know, nothing meant by omission.
Exactly.
You know, Matt Kelly and, you know, and Jackie from Jersey Ghouls. I mean, everybody. There's just so many people that this has just been such a fun ride, you know. And
exactly.
What's exciting is every time I get terrified that I have nothing else to like think of to say, I read something and go, oh my gosh, that's like a whole series of episodes. So, you know, we just plotted out the next couple of months of ideas of what we're going to do that I'm very excited about. So, you know, Fright School's not going anywhere. So, you know,
it's not
a free public service. So we're
exactly.
here.
We would love to be, a paid public service. So, you know, feel free
that's
to
kind
put
of a
money.
Hard thing, you know, paid public service.
A paid public service is like, you know, water, sewer, your public works.
Fright School is as important as water. Absolutely.
Exactly.
Drink your Fright School.
We're a public works.
We are.
Yes. If you collect both
and
of
that's
us,
WERQ,
exactly, like public works. If you collect both of us in Monopoly, you know, we're four times as much in the dice, right? Is that what the utilities, public utilities,
something like that? Yeah, 10 times, I think. Isn't
ooh,
it?
10 times, yeah. So
the
if you
dice roll, it's something like that. I can't
it's
remember.
The dice roll, whatever the dice roll is, and then yeah. Anyway,
yeah, whatever. Some Monopoly enthusiast is gonna be like,
you fucking bitch,
idiots.
Yeah.
All righty. Well, again, thank you, Joe, for 100 episodes, and here's to 100 more, because we've got them in. We have got it in us.
Yeah, we have the spirit. The horror spirit is alive and well.
I do get the spirit in the dark.
Yeah. What?
Aretha?
Is that I don't
in
know that.
The spirit.
No.
Getting in the dark. No.
No.
All right. Well,
no.
I'll play it for you and then you'll know. It's a great song.
Okay.
Anyways, yeah. How dare you?
100 more episodes of me not knowing what Josh was talking about.
Yes, absolutely. And me knowing all too well what Joe is talking about.
Yes.
All right. Well, all I can say is thank you, thank you, thank you for listening. And, you all are, you're the best audience. So, and we appreciate you sticking around. So, and Joe, I love you. And
I love you, Joshua.
Sleep well. Good night.
Good night.
Fright School is produced by Joshua Napier and Joe Farron.
Our intro was edited by Davey Boy Productions.
Our logo was designed by Jamie Channel Guzman.
Episodes are edited and engineered by Joe Farron.
Fright School is produced in terrifyingly beautiful San Diego, California.